we welcome into the program our friend, author Colin Fleming. Check out any of his wonderful books, including Meatheads Say the Realest Things, The Anglerfish Comedy Troupe, and his most recent, If You Brackets, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, Hope. I did not add the end this week just for you. Hello, Colin.
How's it going, Kimball?
I'm well, thank you. Are you fortified with peppermint tea?
I actually have a fresh green tea secured from the procured from the Starbucks moments ago, so I'm ready.
Excellent. Glad to hear that. So you're back. You're hitting the monument. You're hitting the steps. You're the Zulu warrior.
I'm on the road back to full Zulu. When I was in the monument on Sunday, I was using it as an office as I worked out. I was helping my neighbor with her college application process and then texting on the phone. And then when that was done, I was having a very animated conversation on the phone about publishing. I'm sure that was quite the treat for the other people in the monument. And my mom learned about this, and she's like, "Oh, dear, you can't be in that monument on your phone. You're going to fall. It's going to be horrible." And I said, "You know what, Barbara? That's like going up to a spider in the woods and its web and being like, uh-oh, spider, you better be careful. You're going to fall out of your web." I'm not going to fall out of that monument, Kimball. It's not possible. So, yeah, you're right. Full on Zulu. I'll upgrade myself.
Can I ask you a baseball question before we talk about the things on our agenda today?
Fire that fastball in here, Kimball.
Well, it's not. I mean, it's. I'm lobbing it into you. But I'm just curious, if Aaron Judge gets this 60-second home run in the next couple of nights, do you consider that to be the single-season record?
I wouldn't consider it to be, I guess it's sort of semantical, I wouldn't consider it to be the record, but I would look at it as the most favorable single-season home run campaign. Do you know what I mean? So there's like a distinction there. Like, I wouldn't say, like, that is how I would view it when I'm thinking about, you know what, this is strange, but when I think about the all-time home run leader, maybe you do this too, I never think it's Barry Bonds. I mean, do you?
No, never.
Hank Aaron. And Hank Aaron was before my time, so it's not, I'm not that kind of person anyway, but it just, when I think of Barry Bonds, you know who I think of? And I was writing this in the blog, I haven't put it up yet. I think of the guy from like 1991 to 1993. I think of that guy. And like one of the top 30 or 40 players in baseball history, which is really good. That means you're better than like Roberto Clemente and people like that, but not like a top 10 type of player if he's that guy. So I think if Judge gets 62, I would tend to look at it that way. And I am, even though I'm a Red Sox fan, I'm a huge Roger Maris fan. He's always been one of my favorite ball players. And still I've been rooting for Judge. I think the pressure is getting to him. But you know what? When I heard last night that Pujols was second all-time in RBI, that is the statistical story of this remarkable statistical season that everybody is sleeping on. Mm. He's second all-time. That's more impressive than the 62 if Judge gets there, home runs. That's more impressive than Pujols' own 700 home runs. Babe Ruth, RBI, second all-time. Yeah. And it's not like he's that far back of Aaron. That is something that I would not have thought was going to happen. These other things, I could see someone like getting this kind of sort of like season the Judge has had. But passing Ruth is it's like passing Gretzky.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. We want to talk about some wonderful radio treats for the season. And as I was listening to these shows, and of course a kid could do it today, but they were simpler times back in the 40s and 50s. How cool must it have been to be about, I don't know, 10, 11, 12 years old and have so many opportunities to get the wits scared out of you by just turning on the radio?
Were they simpler times, though, Kimball? Because everybody at every point in history thinks about the time before them and thinks, oh, there were simpler times. I don't know. I feel like you can't get much more mindless and simple than our current times. I mean, you ever watch like or read a naval novel? We might have talked about this before. Just the way people talk to like the acting midshipmen or whatever, there's just a style, like an elan to their language that people had then. And now everyone is, now do Trump. They just talk the same way. So I'm not sure. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's sort of this default to verbal gifts culture. So I don't know that it was simpler. But to have this entertainment, I guess the difference is you can just go find it now. But people are such lazy creatures that they will not go find, like, a Twix bar under, like, that couch cushion that was, like, left there from the night before. It'll, like, the Twix will have to come out, levitate itself, unwrap itself, and then magically, like, launch itself into that person's fat gob. So that, like, is what we require now. But you just would have been aware of all of this radio art, radio entertainment, by dint of it was that thing in front of your face or flying into your gob, as it were. So I think that would have been hugely exciting. And it lasts until, these episodes we're going to be talking about, but it lasts until the late 1950s, really. Sometimes even the early 1960s, when essentially, like, rock and roll and everything that brought to the radio killed off this medium, like meteors did asteroids, whatever, the dinosaurs. Like, it was that total. It was pretty much all gone at that point.
Let's start with the Hall of Fantasy in an episode entitled "He Who Follows Me." Very creepy. The Death That Walks.
Hall of Fantasy is something you can sort of, like, tell the depth of commitment of an old-time radio aficionado by how they regard the Hall of Fantasy, because it stands out as the radio show where usually the dark forces are going to win. It's not going to be something like that sends you to bed feeling like you really enjoyed that warm cocoa and now, like, it's sweet slumber time. It's usually upsetting. It doesn't work out the way that the characters wish it to work out. And this is kind of an M.R. Jamesian tale of a guy and a woman who come upon, well, it's like a garage. They go to the garage and there's, like, this tomb there, this sarcophagus, and they're not supposed to see this. And now that they've seen this, they're going to be trailed, stalked, like a very stalkery sort of, like, radio episode, until, they're both no more.
Yeah, and it's intense, and it doesn't let up, and yeah, there's no respite at the end. If you were hoping for that happy twist, you're not getting it in the Hall of Fantasy.
No, we have, like, one survivor at the end, and they're writing like a diary entry. So they're sort of, like, narrating their demise. It's similar to sort of Orson Welles, remember, in The Hitchhiker, where he's playing that character who's stalked himself. It's kind of a similar idea, and he's like in a car park, right? And he's just, you picture him, like, under, like, this, like, pathetic street lamp, scratching out these words and, like, reading them back of, like, here's this man who's coming to get me. So we get that, like, Vin Scully blow-by-blow narration of how this is all ultimately going to end. And it's not like it's telegraphed, because you think that something can't be so unremittingly bleak as the Hall of Fantasy often was, even if you, like, listen to it a lot. But the Hall of Fantasy is like, no, we're doing this. It's really going to be that bleak, and then you're just going to have to cope with that after. It's like I said, it's unremitting. It does not let up, but it's still not like one of those things that doesn't let up, that, like, tests your endurance. I remember the first time I, like, saw a film like Hostel. I just thought, like, what is the appeal of this, to see if I can get through it? Because there's nothing here, like, that's entertaining, or there shouldn't be, unless something really wrong with you. So it's not like that. It's not like suffering porn, if you will.
Mm.
But it's definitely unremitting.
The Hermit's Cave, also with an intense episode as well. Man, don't go in that room. Why do people always go in the room you tell them not to go into?
Yeah, we have this sort of strange threesome in this particular episode of The Hermit's Cave. It's about this forlorn house on this kind of, like, precipice, and it's a sister, her brother, and the sister's husband. And the sister's husband is he's a unpleasant, snappish fellow. And there's a storm. They're trying to come in from the storm. It was a dark and stormy night, and all that jazz. And they pull into, like, this house that two thirds of our trio think is just shelter in the storm that none of them have ever seen before. But it turns out the husband is well acquainted with it. That's like pretty much like a big red flag. And the Hermit's Cave was there are only like a handful of episodes, there are a few dozen that survive today, but it was a staple of the 1930s. And you think like with the Hermit himself, that it's going to be cheesy because these radio shows would have these, some of them would have these horror hosts of the radio. They weren't called horror hosts. And it's not the same as like Quiet Please, where you get that kind of learned coda to each program where Willis Cooper is going to talk about what he wrote for the next week. But these were supposed to be like creepy and funny and Sven Gulli-esque. And you think you're going to be set up for silliness, but you're not set up for silliness at all. We're certainly rarely in the Hermit's Cave, but this is one of the darker, definitely, episodes of the program.
And then finally, an episode of Escape called Evening Primrose. Man, I love this one. It was great. William Conrad stars in it, and wow, the most bizarre department store you'll ever wander into.
This is good. This is a radio episode that I would recommend for people, not just to listen to it once. If you do anything creative, if you write or you make films or study films or literature, I would recommend listening to this multiple times and learning what it does. And that doesn't mean that you take what it does and sort of copy it, but try to find a way to understand how everything functions in this story. It has this wonderful conceit of this poet who turns his back on the world. It's very true to the title. And William Conrad introduces these episodes of Escape, and it's like funny, that voice. He's like, "Hate your uneducated wife, tired of her blathering on. It's time to escape." And I'm like, yeah. Take me away, William Conrad. I enjoy you on Gunsmoke as well. And so the poet has this plan to go to the department store, and he finds like this rug display, and he can create this nook for himself. It's like this cave. It's like a fort, right? When you're a kid, you build the pillow fort, and he's going to live back there. And it turns out at night that there are all of these living beings after a fashion in the department store, and they all hate the night watchman. He becomes like this, it's like when everyone hates the one referee at the sporting event. That's what the night watchman is in this. And what a lot of writers would do, this is John Collier, and people might know him from that Christmas story, Back for Christmas, which was produced for Alfred Hitchcock Presents. It has like this twist at the end, and it's often anthologized. This goes a lot further, because rather than just rely on the conceit, the gimmick, this story is developed. He keeps introducing these new plot points that we don't expect. So it becomes this rich banquet of narrative when someone else would have just been happy enough to have come up with this quirky idea that no one up until that point had had. And it becomes a very moving story, a human story, an odd, a creepy, a sad story. And there's another human in this story. And, I don't know if you remember this, Stu. Were you in Boston? Did you ever go to Filene's basement?
Oh, absolutely.
So when I was a kid, I struggled with escalators because of fear of heights. And I don't go on escalators now. Like, it's weird. When I get off like the T, if I'm coming back from Trader Joe's, I walk around the escalator to get to the stairs. It's part of my Zulu code. But it's also because they make me uneasy. And I've always had a hard time getting on them at the top. And I was there with my mom when I was a kid. It was like 5 or 6. And I timed it wrong, and she went down to the bottom, and I was trapped, right? And this woman interceded, and she, like, got me down to my mom. I thought that was it. I thought we were forever parted at that point. And she's like, "That's silly. Why would you think that?" Well, if I heard this episode of Escape, I could have been like, right? Like, "Oh, you, what about William Conrad and that girl in Escape?"
Yeah.
Could have been, "You're right."
It reminded me of that great Twilight Zone episode with the mannequins in the department store, where one gets to come to life and join the humans for a month.
Yeah, but this goes so much further because
right.
that's an example where it just relies on the conceit that the mannequins come to life and they all like take a turn and someone's like turn lasted longer than it should have. But it's these details too, like when sort of this much anticipated woman who is horrible, she's like the Cruella de Vil of the piece. When she emerges, like we don't even really know what she is. She's sort of like comes down the wall, speaking of spiders, like a spider, but she's not outrightly called a spider.
Yeah.
So there's that right amount of mystery that's going to make your imagination part of this, where you're like, oh no, this is very discomforting for me. And there's like a kind of urbane guy, it's like a Mr. Belvedere type, and there's a love story too, and the love story doesn't work out at all the way that the poet wants it to. And also too, it's, let's not forget this, it's a frame story, and this is really well done, especially on the radio, because you have like this blue collar guy and his wife, and the wife is found like this missive at like the Filene's basement type store, and it's written by the poet, so she's sort of come in possession of his manuscript. And they get to the end, and what you really want with the frame story is you want it to knit up with the action that's been within. Like, you want the outside of the box to sort of twine with the contents of the inside of the box, so there's a congruity there. And there's, like, it's going to be really difficult to write this at the end so that it sort of climaxes with the scream and have that be believable. But that's exactly what happens here.
Yeah, it's great. The world is an intolerable place for a poet.
Yeah, you know what? I have the sense with this poet that it's not like I don't feel like he suffered that much. Like it's sort of gone okay, and maybe he didn't. It doesn't. Another thing that's interesting too, it doesn't sound much like William Conrad, does it?
No. And I thought, well, it says William Conrad, maybe it's just him introducing the piece.
Right, and that could be confusing too about Escape, but this is a few years before Gunsmoke, and here's something that's mind-blowing. Not a lot of people know this. He worked as a producer on The Hermit's Cave.
I saw that, yeah.
That's the type of thing that, like, if you see, you're almost inclined to think, wait, it must be a different William Conrad. But William Conrad, you ready for this, Kimball? I'm going to set you up here. He had his fingers in a lot of pies. Ah.
Especially
Dr. Brownport. Yeah.
Especially when he was canon. Yes, Colin Fleming with us on Downtown. Last week we talked about a wonderful version of Autumn in New York by Charlie Parker, and this week a great version of Autumn Leaves by Miles Davis, and it's another one of those pieces that absolutely evokes the fall, but also is so universal that you would listen to it and love it at any time of the year.
And this is an important recording, too, for Miles Davis, because this is from late September 1964, and we're talking about the version from the Miles in Berlin album. And the reason that's significant is because it was the first official recording of the second great quintet, and you could make an argument that this is the best small band in the history of jazz. You can also make an argument that between the music that they recorded at the end of 1965 at the Plug Nickel in Chicago, and then also Miles Davis's 1970 set, his residency at the Cellar Door Club in Washington, D.C., that those two extended recordings are really all the Davis, I wouldn't say that you need, but they in-house everything else that the man did for all of his many advancements. So this is kind of the start of that journey towards the Plug Nickel recordings in December 1965. And the band right away, they were fully formed. They didn't really have to ramp up to speed. And Davis had a different role with this unit than he did previously, where he was almost a player-conductor. We could think of it as like a player-coach in hockey, or like a Lou Boudreau in baseball type of thing, where the driver of the band is really the very young drummer, Tony Williams. And I don't think there is a player that excited Miles Davis in his entire career quite like Tony Williams did, and the possibilities that he opened up in music. So it's a showpiece for I mean, really the unit, everyone in the unit, the cohesion of the unit. Davis is playing at a high level during this period. Sometimes he wasn't, and it didn't even really like impact the music because he was contributing in other ways. He was an auteur. He was directing. He was shaping. But this is sort of like a perfect representation of autumn, but also, I don't know, we're getting into like this autumn period. We're in the second great quintet, so it makes kind of sonic sense, too.
And great work. Is it Wayne Shorter on the tenor sax?
Yeah, so Wayne Shorter has come along, and he hasn't replaced John Coltrane. It's more like he's replaced Hank Mobley. So he's sort of like filled a different, he's followed like a different giant rather than just coming directly after Coltrane. I think that was like probably easier, but you have Herbie Hancock on piano and like I said, Tony Williams and Ron Carter and Miles Davis doing his thing. But I this is one of those songs that is like Stella by Starlight that Davis played a lot, and you couldn't say that he never played it the same way twice, but you could make like an intensive study of his journey through this song and like make it your dissertation if you were like a music student. This would be one of like the core recordings. It maybe would be where you started with this.
And it's got an interesting beginning to it. I'm like, wait, he's doing Flight of the Bumblebee here. Some really rapid staccato notes early on. And it takes a while to get into the melody that we all know so well.
Yeah, there's a lot of quoting, interpolation in jazz. And Charlie Parker did more of that than Miles Davis. But sometimes you have these songs, and you can have it in rock, too. Like the bird, you know what it reminds me a little bit is quite a bit different. But come 1970... the Birds would do these versions of 8 Miles High where, like, for the first, like, 8 minutes, you wouldn't even know what it was. They were sort of just, like, going off, like, mad, and then the riff would kick in, and everyone was suitably wowed by what they heard, that you can hear the applause, like, when they recognize which song they've been hearing all along. So this is a bit like that, at less volume. This is acoustic jazz, so fusion is still a few years away, but yeah, they're blazing at the start. And it also makes me think of, do you remember that poem we talked about once where John Clare is writing about autumn? There's a coloristic heat, like a temperature. There's like a visual heat to autumn when you see those colors. They're not like greens and blues. They're like sort of like blood blister colors. And so I like how the beginning of this performance like taps into that idea, because when Claire's writing that poem, you almost think that he's going to be writing about summer. It's like going to be sweaty and all that stuff. But no, he really was just going for the coloristic sense of the season.
Finally, a recent wonderful piece you did at thesmartset.com about a reading experience from your youth that has never left, that remains important to you to this day.
Yeah, it's a young adult series called The Three Investigators. And so this is one of the pieces in a book I've recently completed called You're Up, You're Down, You're Up, Essays on Art and Life and Life and Art. And we've actually spoken about the first one, which is about climbing the monument. Oh, and we spoke about the Carlton Fisk, the Catcher one, too. So there's quite a bit of range in this book. But really, the first reading experience that I loved, I mean, I love to read, was when I discovered this series, The Three Investigators, and I was in fourth grade. And I was always done early with whatever my classwork was. And so it was the teacher, they were trying to find something for me to do. And I just remember seeing a cover of one of these books. And I liked Nancy Drew and I liked the Hardy Boys, but this was realer to me. This was more personable, these three fellows, as they're often called in the books, depending on who's writing them. I read them all the time now. I go down to the Starbucks and I can be reading anything there. I can be reading Thoreau's journals. That's sort of like how I might unwind, or I can be reading these books. But they were significant to me because it wasn't just the relatability. I felt like I was in these stories, but also the pace and the plot. And I realized at a very young age that a lot of plot is people, how they're going to interact with each other. And like one of the reasons to me, the only real Star Wars film is so successful is because it has that three investigators quality where it's people hanging out. But as they're hanging out, you're getting to know them and you're coming to know situations better and their concerns. And when you know their concerns, that's advancing the narrative. And we're seeing the decisions people make and the stakes. And that really is plot writing more so than like, behold, I'm blowing something up again. Anyone can do that. It's not engrossing. It's the type of thing, if you're reading that on the subway, by the time you're up above ground again, you forgot what you were just reading. And the three investigators are the antithesis of that. So as much as any like art or entertainment I've ever partaken of, they register as like right at the top of that list for me.
And you draw parallels as well to The Wizard of Oz, to A Christmas Carol, and you mentioned again that it's not the plot. We all know what happens. It's those characters and their interaction, their relationships. That's what brings us back.
Well, I wouldn't say that we know what's going to happen, because there are, like in the storyboarded sense, if you wanted to, it's like how people diagram a sentence. If you wanted to diagram the plot, you don't know ahead of time. And I feel like sometimes when people watch like an old movie mystery, they overstate that so they can be like, I knew it right away. It's like, I feel like if I told you during like the first reel that you wouldn't have known that. But they're well written, and they're written by a handful of different writers. And I kind of go into like their contrasting styles, interestingly, or maybe not, I don't know. But it's a series about three boys and a woman who went by the name M.D. Carrie wrote the best. I feel like she was the truest to like the vision of the series. And it was initiated by Robert Arthur, who had himself had a history in these type of radio programs that we talk about. But you have Pete Crenshaw, investigator number two, with Bob Andrews, records and research, and then the brains of the operation, Jupiter Jones, who's this orphan kid, and he lives in this, lives with his aunt and his uncle, and they have like a junk shop, like a sort of like Sanford and Son, and they build their headquarters out there. Like it's in a fictional California town called Rocky Beach, and like Alfred Hitchcock gets them gigs and stuff, and so they bicycle around. You can sort of deduce that they're about like 15 years old, but they're just really well written, and they're creepy and they're atmospheric, and I just love them so much. I've reread some of these books like 30 or 40 times, and I never get bored of them.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. Next week, let's see, we'll talk about some more old-time radio, including a BBC production, The Unquenchable Thirst of Dracula, a little Who live in Chicago, and some Dylan in Norway as well. All that next week when Colin joins us.
Ah, you set that up well, Kimball.
Teeing it up for you. Have a great week, Colin. We'll see you Tuesday.
All right, sounds good.
Colin Fleming on Downtown.